couple other reminders. At the end of the presentation, we will post a link to a survey evaluation. If you could please take a few minutes to complete that, we do greatly appreciate your feedback. We do look at that information going forward in planning.
Me either.
Well, I'm getting some feedback. Somebody else on the call here? Bear with me 1 second. Okay, we should be okay. So a couple more reminders. Good news, we have our Strand 4 series posted to our webpage. The topic for Strand 4 is recognition and response. Our TI goes to pre-K. There are 5 webinars in that series. That series starts March 17th, goes through the end of April on Mondays. Registration and information is available on our webpage. I will post the webpage in the chat box in just a minute. Today is the first webinar in Strand 3 series. Our topic for Strand 3 is using RTI model to differentiate and support the ELA Common Core. Today's topic is operationalizing the 6 shifts of Common Core learning standards within an RTI framework. We have Dr. Catherine Doherty Stahl. Dr. Stahl will be with us for the entire Strand 3 series. We have 4 webinars scheduled. Today is the first one. The next one is February 24th at 4 p.m. The topic for that one is complex text meeting the needs of diverse learners. So we hope you can join us for that one as well. So without further ado, we are very pleased to have Dr. Stahl with us today. Dr. Stahl is a clinical associate professor of education at New York University. She comes with over 25 years of classroom experience. Her research interests include reading acquisition and reading comprehension, and she has authored and co-authored a number of books on reading assessment and reading instruction, and we are just thrilled to have her with us today. So at this point, I would like to turn it over to Dr. Stahl.
Thank you, Molly, and thanks to all of you for being here. I know this makes for a very long day, so I appreciate you being here and joining us for this webinar series. I think the first thing I'd like to, so what we'll be talking about is the relationship between RTI and the Common Core standards, and also the non-negotiables, which I believe are those 6 shifts, and we'll talk a little bit about what they actually look like in practice. How do they look in a classroom? And also, where are you individually as a teacher, and where is your school in making that shift? And basically, I designed this presentation with the following audience in mind. School personnel who are directly responsible for implementing and supporting core instruction. And that would include classroom teachers, interventionists, literacy specialists, literacy coaches, and principals and assistant principals. This presentation will meet the needs of those particular kinds of instructors. So, Molly, I think this is the slide where we're going to ask the audience who they are, and you will have a chance to provide some feedback to me as well in terms of who you are. Last time was the first time I had ever done a webinar, and I said, I feel like I'm in a dark hole. I really don't know if people are even out there. So I said, is there some way that we can get some audience response? So this is a way for me to know who you are and to be able to tailor the presentation a little bit to what your needs are. And while you're telling me who you are, as Molly said, I was a classroom teacher for 27 years. And now I'm a clinical associate professor at NYU, and I still work with a lot of schools, and in the reading clinic here, I continue to work with children. For the last 5 years, I've been a member of the RTI, Technical Assistance Consortium, and for the last 3 years, I've been working with the New York State ELA Content Advisory Panel. So, but what you're going to hear from me today is basically, you know, I'm not representing the RTI Technical Assistance Center, nor am I representing the state ELA Content Advisory Panel. So I am basically representing the work that I have done and the research that either I have done or that others in the field have done. Well, it looks like we've got a nice broad spectrum of people attending today. That's fantastic. Very broad group. So Molly, can we go to the next slide, or I think okay. So in an increasingly complex world, sometimes old questions require new answers, and that really is the world that we find ourselves in today. And so in looking at the policies, recent policies, how do RTI and the Common Core relate to each other? Basically, the RTI framework is the infrastructure it's the structure that all of the other elements fit into. So, for example, we have the Common Core, which are the large grain what we teach at a very large grain level. That's the content. Then we engage in this assessment, analysis, and action cycle, and this is described more fully on the Engage New York website, and it's also the cycle of RTI, in which we do assessment, we analyze the data, and then that informs the instruction that we engage in. And this would be, though, when we engage in this kind of assessment, it's small grain skills, whereas the Common Core is large grained outcomes. So there is a little bit of a difference there that we need to discriminate as classroom teachers and as interventionists. And then the tiered instruction is where children would be placed in terms of their response to that assessment and action cycle. And the Common Core is very deliberate in saying, unlike the old policy of reading first, the Common Core document is very deliberate in saying they are not going to tell us how or what to teach. And so therefore, they leave it up to us as responsible professionals to know what the most up-to-date research is in and what the most effective practices are. So with that, we would rely on the research findings from the National Reading Panel, as well as the newer research about reading that's published every month and that has been coming out every month over the last 13 years since the National Reading Panel findings. And then there's the professional development link, which feeds into all those other columns in our individual school. What is it that our teachers need to enable them to provide the research-based instruction that will allow our children to achieve those standards? So in summary, the Common Core tells us what we teach at a large grain level. The National Reading Panel and 13 years of new reading research tell us how we teach and what instructional methods we use. And then the RTI provides that infrastructure for applying the small grain details and within this multi-tiered system of supports. So let's think about what can we learn from the 2013 ELA test results. Now we're not going to have you're not going to be able to provide an answer for this in your response format, but I want you to just think about what did we learn from the ELA test results last April that we received in August. A, the test was unfair. If we wait it out, it has to change. We need a new style of test prep booklets to be more effective. Or instruction needs to shift, but can we really do what is being demanded of us and our kids? Or we need more tier two and tier three resources. And the only one correct answer is item D. Instruction does need to shift, but I know many of us question, can we really do get our children to those high levels of comprehension that are being demanded. So if we look at a tiered model, and we attempt to apply that tiered model, the original RTI model that we tend to be familiar with is that tier one should, and that's general education classroom instruction, should be able to meet the needs of 80% of our population. And then there may be 20% of the children in our general ed classroom that will need something extra. Of that 20% who need something extra, tier two should be able to meet the needs of 15%, with only 5% needing tier three or even perhaps special education. So when we look at the ELA test results, from that we received in August, and we learned that around the state of New York, 69% of the children did not achieve at proficient levels. There were 69% of the children who achieved at levels number one and two. What we see there is a mismatch, that in our classrooms, only 31% of the children, general education was only meeting the needs or providing the kind of instruction needed for 31% of that the children. Now, we still only have resources. We do not have the resources in our schools to provide the kind of intense instruction, the kind of small group instruction that is characteristic of tier two and tier three. So when we see numbers like this, what it tells us is not that 69% of our children need tier two instruction. What it tells us is that we need to take a closer look at our tier one instruction to find out how can we tweak that instruction so that this number of children that whose needs are being met in tier one will rise to that 80% figure. What can we do to tweak tier one instruction so that it will meet the needs of 80% of our children? And that is what we really need to look at. Because in terms of resource allocation, tier two groups must be small. The maximum number of children in tier two groups must be 6 to 8 children. And these groups, they should be grouped homogeneously. I think the number 6 to 8 is even pretty generous, is a little large. Ideally, those groups in tier two are really only 4 to 6 children. Also, tier two groups must meet a minimum of 3 times a week. So how can we adjust this instruction? Well, first of all, in kindergarten through first grade, I think some of the ways that we might adjust is if we're working with just a block of instruction, the ideal for children in K-1 is a 30-minute block. That's better than 45 minutes. That might be a place where we can tweak the tiered instruction. But however, grades 2 through 5 do need 45 minutes of instruction. Another place that we can really take a look at instruction to see if we're using resources well to sort of bolster that classroom instruction is when we are using co-teaching models of instruction, let's take a look at how we can maximize the teaching time of teachers in a co-teaching model with small groups rather than having and do some parallel teaching rather than just having one teacher teaching with the other person walking around. So those are some things that we do need to take a look at. The other thing that I think schools will need to do is readjust, take a look at the current assessments that they are using, the current formative that they are using during the school year, to audit what assessments are we using to figure out where our children are throughout the year. And this assessment audit, there's a model of it, a wonderful model found on the RTI Technical Assistance Center website, the same website where you registered for this presentation. And I believe the audit forms are found on under the pilot schools and the forms. And we, some of the things that you want to really take a look at is your school assessment system. How are you conducting your training to make sure that there is fidelity and consistency in the way the tests are being administered and scored? What kinds of assessments are you using? Are you using assessments that align with the Common Core? Are you having data meetings and identifying children who would most benefit by the kinds of interventions that you're offering in your tiers? And are they, and is there an alignment of the assessments that you're, the classroom's assessments that you're using, is there an alignment with the new Common Core standards? And who is administering those tests? Is there one system of assessments that are being administered in a very kind of what I like to call that lean and mean way, so that we're not having tier one and tier two and tier three teachers duplicating each other's works, but rather you three, the people in those roles are working together to get information that that can be used to inform each of the tiers, and that there is both reliability and collaboration in that model. And then that there is a decision tree constructed to determine cutoff scores that will inform the group placement in your tiered interventions, and that those interventions are matched with what children's needs are reflected on the formative and the screening assessments. And that finally, professional development can be used to expand and improve both the administration of the assessments and the interventions that children need to meet their needs. However, the six shifts are the non-negotiables in Tier 1 instruction. Before we can begin to differentiate, before it, either in our classroom or in the interventions, in the small group interventions, we need to guarantee a healthy Tier 1 classroom, 120 minutes of literacy instruction that is built around these non-negotiables of the Common Core. And we all need to be on board and have a common vision for what those shifts look like. Now, you all have certainly heard of the six shifts, and there have been countless presentations and videos being conducted around the state on the six shifts. And so we are going to go through each of these six shifts and look at them individually, but we're going to take a little deeper look at what these actually look like in your classrooms. Okay, so let's start with Okay. And so we're going to do somewhat of a self-inventory, as I said, at your school level and your class. Okay. In terms, the first shift is balance of informational and literary text. So ask yourself at your school and in your classroom, is there truly a 50-50 time allocation balance? And we're talking about, yes, that 120 minutes. We really do need 120 minutes. I can see a corner of the chat over here that I see someone saying something about 120 minutes. And yes, we do need 120 minutes built into the day. And when we're doing integrated units of instruction as are mandated by the Common Core, then that opens up your schedule to be teaching literacy and your science and social studies within that 120 minutes. And that balance of information and literary, you ask yourself, what are the units of study that we are teaching at our school? If you're spending 90 minutes in the morning teaching reading sustenance or picking the right book or small moments of writing, then you may have difficulty acquiring the 120 minutes. However, if you're doing the 120 minutes on something that is a unit such as a disciplinary theme such as the body or plant life or weather systems or tall tales, then you're able to make a more flexible use for your allocated time during the day. Is reading still the curriculum bully? Because basically in the Common Core, what we want to begin to do is use reading and writing as a paradigm for cognition. They are taught as a means to mediate thought and conceptual development. It's not like we have reading in the morning and now in the afternoon, if we have time, we're going to squeeze in a little social studies and science. Reading, writing, and language, speaking, vocabulary are being taught in authentic ways rather than in isolation. And we need to take a look at that test. Each grade's test manual has a list of the different kinds of texts that are that need to be incorporated across this spectrum of the of an elementary grade level. Biographies, forms, newspapers, all the, you know, fables, tall tales, all of these kinds of genres need to be included. And when we are teaching disciplinary, when we're balancing that literary and informational text in authentic, within disciplinary units, we are able to really make good use of our time, and children are able to use reading and writing as a way to develop conceptual knowledge. So that we're actually weaving reading, writing, and language into conceptual development. This is David Pearson, not Pearson Publishing, David Pearson's model of how that looks. So we have reading, writing, and language. And in the primary grades, that would dominate the reading, writing, and language instruction and your teaching science and social studies and literary units. However, in the upper grades, the disciplines dominate science, social studies, literature. You wouldn't really have these as separate times of the day. Because the way different people, like if you're reading like a historian, even though some of the common strategies, such as monitoring, question generation, summarizing, and I think we have this on the next slide, these are common strategies, whether you're doing a literacy block or a science block. So these are really done in both, so there's no need to conduct them separately. These are all common to both. However, there are some disciplinary strategies that are unique and ways of evaluating that are unique to the discipline. So therefore, we want to be teaching reading and writing and language in integrated ways. The next shift is text complexity. Children must be hearing and reading complex text. I think that it's a good idea to use the gradient, Founis and Pinnell levels, or some other level like that that is that takes in qualitative factors of how children learn how to read in kindergarten through mid-second grade. However, I do believe that by the time children get to that mid-second grade level, and certainly in grades three and above, we really need to shift to lexiles to determine their reading level. In these upper grades, when we're talking about comprehension, the lexiles, the way lexiles are determined is based on traditional methods words, novel words, sentence length, unique words, and those things are more closely related to what makes a text difficult to understand. And so therefore, it will be more sensitive to reading levels of children in the intermediate grades and beyond. Those kinds of gradient levels, such as Founis and Pinel, are more sensitive in the primary grades to the needs of children. But we need to, as we begin to look at second grade, mid-second grade and beyond, teachers need to be aware instructionally in exposing children to complex text, even children who are struggling readers or in special education. This is the difficulty band that we have all been presented with. Now, these lexiles in this column are the bands that we have been told to prepare children to be able to read in second grade with support, and in third grade independently, fourth grade with support, fifth grade independently, and so on. These levels over here are the Founis and Pinel levels that are equivalent to these lexiles. If we want our children to have a healthy text complexity diet, then here are the contexts that we need to be sure are a part of that 120 minutes of our reading day. We need to include a teacher read aloud, whether children are in kindergarten or whether they are in fifth grade or in upper grades. This is a time to present the complex text. This is a time that we need to remember that our primary purpose is comprehension and vocabulary. We need a shared reading time with grade level text. Our focus here is comprehension, vocabulary, and fluency. We also need a time when children are reading text at their traditionally established instructional reading levels. This GR is not Founis and Pinel, it's lowercase GR. That means, I don't care what you call it, this is when kids are reading instructional level text and when they are orchestrating the reading process and when they are orchestrating decoding, fluency, and comprehension together at text at their instructional level. These are more complex. This is done whole class, small teacher-led groups. That's what those initials stand for. And then the independent, which would certainly be one of the stations during guided reading. I think one of the things that we need to ask with the demand of complex text is, how much time is allocated for read-alouds of complex text, which is that's where you should be, those lexiles, those high lexiles that we've asked ourselves, can we demand that of our children? Those high lexiles, that is where we want to allocate children. That's where time is allocated for the most difficult text. That's our read aloud time. And then shared reading, when children have their eyes on text, and our next webinar is going to focus exclusively on this challenge of how to provide shared reading that supports reading of stretched text. So I hope that you all will stay tuned for our next webinar that really focuses on this very large challenge that we all are facing. And how much time is being allocated for children to be held accountable for reading connected text at their instructional level with small group teacher support. And the next slide provides a model of what that time. Some of you folks asked the question of how do we fit in, you know, what do we fit into that 90, 120 minutes? How can we do that in our schedule? Well, here is a model of how that schedule might look. Our teacher read aloud from 15 to 30 minutes. In the upper grades, that would probably only be 15 minutes. In K-2, you probably need 30 minutes, whether it's 15 and 15, whether it's a whole 30-minute block, if you're using something like our research-validated Beck and McCallum model of text talk, that takes a good 30 minutes for a read aloud. Older children might only need 15 minutes of a read aloud of an authentic primary source, a newspaper, a journal article of some sort. And that's our most complex text. And it's whole class. We want mixed heterogeneous group here. Shared reading. This is complex text, not quite as difficult as the read aloud. 45 minutes. This is where children are reading complex text. They are, it's an anchor text that you're using for your theme integrated disciplinary instruction. That's what this pink means, that it's integrated instruction, it's disciplinary. And this is 45 minutes, complex text. Small group independent, you're going to have 60 minutes because you're going to have small group work and also independent work being done at that time. Primary, for example, you might have 4 15-minute groups in kindergarten and early first. You might have 23 20-minute groups in first grade and second grade. And in the upper grade, third grade, you'll have 2 30-minute groups. And this is differentiated. And you must have some phonics. Let's not forget our phonics. Let's not let our word study get lost in the focus on comprehension. And this would be by ability level, differentiated, but 15 to 30 minutes. Now, these, I'm going to back up to this. It doesn't really matter what program you're using. You still need to have these components. And it doesn't, and if we take a look at this slide, this is a review of some of the common programs that I expect you all are using. Perhaps a Basel Reader, perhaps Teachers College Workshop, a reading and writing workshop model, what the Lucy Calkins version of Teachers College. This is guided reading, Fallis and Pinnell, the capital GR. This is our core knowledge that's found on Engage New York, your core knowledge modules. This is expeditionary learning, and this is CAFE, the sisters. Some schools use the sisters, the CAFE model. Now, the pink ones are based on interdisciplinary themes. They're already organized in that way. Now, these columns on this matrix are the materials that these programs provide to you. Read aloud and shared writing. Shared reading, shared writing. Guided reading, guided writing. Independent reading, independent writing, or word study. So if you look across, for example, if you have subscribed to a Basel reading program, all of these are being provided for you in your Basel reading program. The read aloud, the writing in response to that, shared writing, interactive writing, shared reading materials, your anthology for all your kids. You've got the little leveled readers as part of that. It doesn't really give suggestions for independent. If you're adhering to Readers Writers Workshop, you have a little mini lesson, which is conducted as a read aloud, and then the kids go off and read and write by themselves in a workshop model with you conferencing. However, these components, the shared reading is missing, the guided reading is missing. And so you would then need to find a way to provide that with the materials. You need to supplement that. They don't provide it. And so that is same thing, core knowledge. Core knowledge does a phenomenal job of providing some wonderful, rich read-alouds and instruction and vignettes for how to use those read-alouds and some suggestions for writing in response to those read-alouds. It also provides some work for independent writing, and it provides the foundational skills. However, it does not provide any bridge here. You are going to need to provide that, because in second grade, we can't just have kids move from being read to being able to then, in third grade, being able to read complex text. So you're going to have to fill in this gap with some with reading materials for shared reading. And so no program is complete. No program is complete. We need to teach what our children need to learn and use the materials as tools. Okay, text-based answers. I'm going to shift my screen over here to see. Okay, I see someone is asking some questions about the Lexile for 740 to 1040. The Lexiles, all the Lexiles that are recommended, now I'm having trouble switching back, the Lexiles, the test guides, I strongly recommend that you all explore on the Engage New York website. Each grade level has test guides provided to it. And on those test guides, all of the Lexiles are presented. Or you can even go to the Lexile website and the Lexiles are presented that are required for each grade level. And I'm going to be revisiting that as well. And I think that you'll be able to access this chart and this PowerPoint and get all of this information later. And perhaps we can provide some feedback on that a little later. I think this is going to be accessible. These are accessible on the RTI website. So you'll be able to refer back to that and look at it at your leisure. Text-based answers. This is the newest catchphrase, text evidence. I think that, I don't know whether the rest of you are as sick of hearing that already as I am. Oh my gosh. I mean, it's like, let's use text evidence. The point is that we certainly want kids to use text evidence, but we want them to do it in a thoughtful way, not in a way that they're parroting something. Like my old catchphrase that used to drive me nuts was text-to-text connections or text-to-self connections, and children would spit that out without really being mindful of what the text-to-text connection was or what the text-to-self connection was or what the text-to-world connection was. And I am very worried that we're going to get children doing that same kind of rote response. Whereas the point is really for children to make causal connections across a piece of text, to look at a character's mental shifts across a piece of text. What is the character's motivation? And to really think about what children need to think about and to use the text in a meaningful way that helps them make connections across a piece of text and to be able to apply that in both reading and their writing. And what counts as evidence is discipline specific. And that's why it's so important for us to be treating these, is to be teaching these integrated disciplinary units rather than reading being our curriculum bully and feeling like we have to teach it in isolation. Because what counts as evidence is different in history than it is in science. Now, so what are some of the classroom formats that you're using to facilitate children learning what counts as evidence and how to represent it in the discipline's discourse? I think a narrative writing about your personal experience with plants doesn't really count as scientific evidence. And so we need to be teaching children how to write like a scientist, how to read with the lens of a historian, and then to write like a historian. And we really need to be doing that in ways that are situated in authentic practice. The KWL, the story map are not necessarily the best ways of getting to this level of high thinking. So an example is our a story that a classroom that I'm familiar with was using this book, The Other Side. The Lexile, it was used in second grade. The Lexile was 300. It's Founis and Pinel level M. This was used in a second grade classroom as a read aloud. I personally would have used it as a shared reading. That's right in the sweet spot for second graders shared reading. The book theme was segregation. However, in the pre-Common Core era, a teacher I know used this, and she the book The Other Side is about these two kids who sit on a fence. Each day they see each other. One is an African-American child. The other is a white child. They see each other, and the fence separates them. And so the teacher uses it. She talks about how do the characters feel? Have you ever made friends with someone different than you? And how can you include someone who is different? This was a fine kind of lesson for before the Common Core, all right? However, today, that would not cut it. This is a very rich text, and we need to take advantage of the fodder for comprehension instruction and deep thinking. Today, we need to be getting children to think about the theme and what is the theme, what is the universal message of this text. For this text, it was social justice. So instead of just asking the kids what was the setting of this book, the importance of the setting is how does it influence the events of the story? Why is the character sitting on the fence? And then discuss the fence as a symbol for racial boundaries. To have classroom discussions about what does it mean to push boundaries? What does it mean to push the rules? And then to have a compare and contrast the girls' way of dealing with boundaries and their mother's way of dealing with boundaries. This is a much more rich, high-level approach to this book than what was used for the exact same book in the past. Okay, so now what I would like you to do, Molly, this is a place where we have our, I would like you to think about what you wrote and what you read yesterday, all right? How much of the time that you spent reading yesterday and writing, engaging in literary activities, what percent of that time in literacy-based activity, what percent of your time was spent reading? What percent of your time was spent writing? So what percent of the, so if you spent 2 hours reading yesterday, was 1 hour spent reading and 1 hour writing, or did you spend, if you spent 2 hours yesterday reading and writing, did you spend 1.5 hour reading and a shorter time writing? Okay, so we're seeing probably, I'm having a hard time reading this on this, let me switch this over, there we go. Okay, so it will be interesting to see, I'm not really sure, so we have, it seems that people did spend more time, more of the time was spent reading than time spent writing. So, for example, 10%, large people spent 10% of the time writing, but of the time they spent engaged, more of that time was spent reading. Molly, can we go to the next slide now? That's the next response. It's the one about that starts with diary, journal. It's another insert. So now I would like you to check all that apply. Everything that applies, go ahead and respond to what you wrote. What is it that you, what was the content of what you wrote in, within the last week? What have you written? It's Valentine's. I'm looking for some love letters. If you haven't written a love letter yet in preparation for Valentine's Day, perhaps that would be a good goal for this week. Okay, so if we look at what we have written, I think we can see that more of the writing has to do with purposeful writing in response or as opposed to narrative writing. I see a lot more professional emails, text messages, letters to parents, lesson plans. Okay, Molly, we can now switch to the next slide. And so I hope that will bring to the forefront that most of the writing that we do is personal, is purposeful, not personal. We rarely write narratives, yet they often dominate school writing programs. And I am aware of any research supporting any kind of 50-50 reading-writing balance. Yet we frequently see, when I go in schools, I also see teachers trying to ensure, well, I've got to make sure my kids are writing as much as they're reading, and that I've got this fake balance of 50-50 reading and writing. And I'm not really sure where that balance has come from. Because if you looked at the work that you did and the kind of writing that the people that we did, most of the writing is purposeful and informational and explanatory or persuasive. It is good learning theory to contextualize your writing experiences as a part of your shared reading or in response to your read alouds. Use the state rubrics, and it's very important to maintain this kind of balance. And also to have multiple writing contexts, have whole class and individuals writing, have individuals, so we have shared writing where the teacher models writing and the teacher's holding the pen, modeling different genres of writing. There's the interactive, which is also done whole class, where teachers and students might share the pen. Then in a small group, have some, which would be need-based, where students write their individual products, and the teacher is providing guidance. And finally, having the writing workshop. But there should be a balance of these four types of writing. No one of them should dominate. I think that some of the battle that we have been encountering in some schools that I visit is that there is some resentment that the Common Core privileges writing in response to text as opposed to creative writing and personal writing. And I think this is something that we need to address openly. And how is it that, you know, why are we attached perhaps to a writing model that doesn't teach writing craft in authentic context for disciplinary and academic purposes? And let's talk about how we can remediate some of these affective or some of the resistance that we have to helping children write in response to text and for purposes. And our sixth shift is academic vocabulary. And the goal that we want to do here is to build transferable vocabulary that children need in order to access these complex texts. And there is a list. I'm not sure if any of you are using this list. There is a list that has gone around some of the schools I've worked in, this academic vocabulary list. And that's a list that was created by a researcher named Coxhead in her work that she did with English learners. And this was some essential academic vocabulary that she believed that they needed in order to be successful in academic tasks. Some people and some schools have adopted this list and are just teaching it as an isolated word list as, well, this week we're going to teach this list of 12 words from this list. Next week we'll teach the next list. The integration, this list should be integrated in authentic ways with the kind of content disciplinary units that you're instructing. We also, so we want to use words as tools, not just as isolated lists that we want kids to memorize. We also want kids to be aware of some of what Beck and McAllen call their tier two words. These are words that are not necessarily related to a discipline. However, these are words that are sophisticated words that children may, that they know the meaning for, and they know these words conceptually, but they may just be using a more simplistic word in their own language. So all of these kinds of words need to be addressed. So some of what you may want to ask yourself is, in my classroom, is vocabulary instruction meaningfully situated within instructional units, or is it just isolated and unrelated to anything? And I think a good task would be for schools to sit down grade level by grade level, would be, I'm glancing at some of the questions I'm getting here too, so that's why I'm switching. I don't know whether you can see me switching or not. So one of the things, one thing that I think is really essential, at a grade level, sit down and talk about what are the instructional disciplinary units that we're teaching, and for each of those disciplinary units, what are the 12 to 15 words that we really want our children to own? And then think about ways that you're going to crisscross the landscape throughout the unit to teach those words, and also have develop assessments for those words. I think there, I wrote an article with Marco Bravo that appeared in The Reading Teacher, I think it was in 2010, on some formative kinds of assessments that are very easy for you to develop, and that the National Reading Panel actually recommends for assessing vocabulary. And I think that we have got to do this for ourselves, because if we do not grab this bull by the horns, we are going to have policymakers and other people who know nothing about vocabulary instruction or teaching reading tell us how to test vocabulary. So I think if we want to avoid that, it's really important for us to begin to do that on our own in ways that are theoretically sound. And I also think that, you know, by incorporating integrated units, we are also doing a form of sheltered instruction. So many of our classrooms today do have English learners. We cannot avoid that. And this is a way, by having integrated units and by really being deliberate in targeting that kind of vocabulary through those units, we are enhancing the comprehension of our English language users, our English language learners, and providing opportunities for them to read, write, and use in conversation the academic vocabulary that they need to be successful. Also, I think you want to be deliberate and planful in figuring out appropriate ways and a trajectory for generative word learning practices to be incorporated in your curriculum. For example, the affixes, the Greek and Latin root words. Where are they introduced is where you have them now, developmentally appropriate. How are we doing this in a systematic way? And really trying to do this in a way that is systematic for your classroom, your grade level, and your school. And I do just want to close with the idea that I will be the first to admit that the Common Core learning standards and the new tests are certainly not perfect, but they are better gauges of authentic reading than anything that has preceded them. I know back when, in my early days of teaching and even in the late days of teaching, the kind of standardized tests that my children took were very low-level thinking. You know, find the main idea. What happened first? What happened last? What does this vocabulary word mean? They were very low-level kinds of questions. That was not the kind of thinking that I wanted my children to be doing as a teacher. I wanted my children to be thinking at much higher levels. And so I think the good news about the test today is that they are asking our children to think at more sophisticated levels. And I think the 21st century demands it. So I think that's the good news. And it's not really, you know, what's important for us, though, is to make sure how can we get our children prepared to be thinking about text in new ways at high levels as part of our classroom routines. For that child who is the special education child or the child who is the struggling reader, the kids who I like to call those kids I love, how can I ensure that through my year of working with that child, that when they come across a complex text, either in their own reading or on a test at the end of the year, they have a high tolerance for many unknown words? That it's not, oh, I can't do this, so I quit. I might as well not do any of it. But that they encounter that challenging text and they say, I may not know every word on this page, but I can grapple with this text and engage in tasks around this text because I've done this in my classroom and I know that I can do it. And it's not just about plucking standards to map on to lesson plans, and it's not about teaching to the test. In my heart, I truly do believe it's about the kids. I would not be in this profession if I didn't believe that that what I did and that what each of you did and do every day saves lives. I believe that we have the power to reduce jobless rates among our poorest. It's about reducing teenage pregnancies. It's about reducing dropout rates. It's about reducing addiction and incarceration. What each of you are doing in your classrooms every day makes a difference in these important ways. And I certainly applaud you for doing it. So thank you so much for being with me today. And we have plenty of time for some questions now. And as I said, these slides will be available to you on the website for you to peruse at your leisure. But now I'm going to, you know, we have some time to answer some of your questions. Thank you, Teresa. Do we have some questions? We have a few minutes. You can type in your questions on the chat. And please join us for the future sessions. As I said, the next session, to give you a little preview, the next session, I think you'll really find the next session very compelling as well. Our next session will be about shared reading and complex text. And I know that has really been one of the challenges that we have all encountered, how to make those complex texts those hard texts accessible to all of our children. So we will really focus on that in detail during our next presentation. I hope you all will return for that session. It was also nice seeing you, even though I didn't quite get the swing of some of those responses. It was really great to at least see some of you out there, so I didn't feel so alone on the during the webinar as I did the last time. And do feel free to share this information with your colleagues or to email me personally as well. Do feel free to contact me for additional information related to applying this to your individual school. Gail, hello. It's so great to see you up there. Thank you so much for tuning in. I don't know about the accessing it before. I think I will have a discussion with Teresa about that in terms of note-taking. Great to see you, Daisy, too. I'm so glad to see some familiar names up here, and thank you for saying hello to me and letting me know that you're there. I appreciate you being here after a long, long day of school. Here's a question. How frequently do you recommend SRI testing to gauge Lexile score? I would say, now remember with comprehension is an unconstrained ability, so it's not going to have the big shifts in a timely way, such as you see with decoding. So I would say that you really wouldn't want to do it any more regularly than, say, every two or three months, I think is fine. Oh, I think it's great to inform parents about the Lexiles, and that Lexile.com is just a wonderful website. No, Jane, I too recommend for parents. In fact, letters that I write to parents or my parents of the children that I see in the reading clinic, I do exactly what you said. I refer them to that Lexile.com website and have them, put their child's text level in or the Lexile and to find books there. I think one of the only things, Jane, to add to that is perhaps for children who are in second grade, third grade, whose parents are still accustomed to using Foundis and Pinnell text levels, perhaps providing them with some kind of a resource where they can translate and convert the Foundis and Pinnell text levels into Lexiles. That might be another useful tool for parents if their child's school is only using Foundis and Pinnell levels. So, in sixth grade science, should I be spending all my class time reading nonfiction articles instead of doing hands-on activities? No, I believe that you should be doing a combination. Now, your ELA partner should not be just doing science, and I'm sure she's not. I'm sure your ELA partner is balancing her time with history, literary text. Well, at a middle school, I would think that Maria, it depends on whether you're in a middle school, the compartmentalized setting, or whether you're in a sixth grade whole class setting. So, but in any case, you should be having some hands-on activities, but you should also be doing reading and writing at of grade level disciplinary text, science text that accompany your unit, and teaching your children how to do writing like a scientist writes, whereas the ELA teacher may be doing some work with that, but she also has the responsibility for teaching literary. So we can't just rely on her to do only the science. I mean, that would only be one third of her responsibility. Well, so if your partner is teaching ELA and social studies, then I don't think you should be relying on her to be teaching kids to read like a scientist. I think that reading like a scientist and writing like a scientist needs to be coming out of your lessons, because it's the that is a particular discourse of its own, and by discourse I'm talking about that capital D discourse. Some good articles that I would reference you to are Elizabeth Moje, M-O-J-E, talks a great deal about teaching science in a way that you are teaching the language of science, the reading of science, and making a conceptual model, mental representation as we read things and do things and have the hands-on experiences, and then to be able to write like a scientist. So I think that I'm not sure you should be relying at sixth grade on your ELA teacher to be doing that. Absolutely. Yeah, those correlations. Yeah, they are out there. You can just Google. You really can just Google that and get those correlations for Lexiles and those Lexiles and the Foundas and Pinel or any other kind of reading leveling system that your school might be using. So. Yes, please do feel willing to share any of this information. Other questions? So what tips do you have for helping ESL students keep up when they miss instruction? Oh, that's a great question. That's a great question. I think really, Nicole, and for others, I mean, the best things that we can do is to be using integrated disciplinary instruction. And so therefore, they're going to be in your class. They're going to be in your class when you're doing some of the hands-on activities. And so even though they may be leaving your class for 40 minutes or 45 minutes, then the bulk of your block of time is devoted to reading, writing, and talking about the unit. So let's say you're doing a unit on plants. Well, you may be doing during shared reading. You would certainly want them to be there during shared reading, so that they get some of that information about that's in the anchor text, and that also they are being able to participate in the follow-up discussion groups. So, for example, you would say read an anchor text on day one, day two. The children are reading that anchor text and discuss and practicing reading it. Day three, they would be doing some discussion. So you want to make sure that your English learners are in there during that time when they're having the discussion about the text that the class read, and that they're able to participate in some of the writing activities as well. So that if you're doing those units, though, in a disciplinary unit, you're having so much repetition of that vocabulary, so that even though they may be missing one or two components of that whole lesson, all right, because so much of your class literacy activities are embedded in that content, even if they are missing some of the components, they are getting it at other times. Also, how would you, so one more, how would you present newspaper information to low readers? Again, I think it's that the aspect of the contextualization and the amount of support. So if you're using newspapers, doing it as a read aloud, and then having children respond to the read aloud so that they're having opportunities to do repeated readings of that, and then having them, or dividing it into chunks for specific purposes, I think those are all ways to provide various levels of scaffolding. Janice L. Macy has a wonderful chart that talks about all the different kinds of scaffolding that to be used. And this would be appropriate, I think, for all children, but I think it also applies to the earlier question about English learners, to the question, how do I scaffold newspaper articles? And in her chart, across the top, it's a matrix, and across the top of the matrix, she has the different levels of experiences that are from least scaffolding, or from most scaffolded experiences to least scaffolded experiences. And then on the right, and on the left hand going down, she has the amount of help. So for example, across the top, it would be hands-on experiences are the most heavily scaffolded. Next might be teacher, might be a picture book. Next might be, a regular text. Then going down, a teacher. So a teacher reading aloud a picture book is a more heavily scaffolded experience than a teacher reading aloud a book that doesn't have pictures. And so by using this matrix, you can find any number of ways to scaffold experiences. And if you find that asking children to read a newspaper article by themselves independently is too difficult, well, then you try it with them doing it with a partner. If that still isn't enough support, then you try doing it in a small group. And so you just try to mediate through different levels of scaffolding how to find the sweet spot of the level of support that they need to be successful. Okay, next question. Do you see the RTI model falling into place, or do you think there will be continued to be a much higher need for remediation? My classes are becoming maxed out and students are not getting, oh, Salvatrice, I hear you. I feel your pain, truly. This is really a challenge. 14 students in a classroom of a tier two is not tier two. That group is too large. Now, the let's hope that by you and other people at your school who are tier one teachers viewing presentations like these, that their recognition will come to be that in tier one instruction has got to shift. There is no way that 69% of those kids that scored in those low proficiency categories need tier two help. What they need is instruction in the general ed classroom that is more closely aligned with what the Common Core is demanding. And so as those classrooms begin to really believe that the state does mean business, and that it's, you know, all those other choices on that questionnaire, or on the questionnaire that I gave about what does the ELA test show us, that the test is not going to change. It is going to be that hard. And what we need to change is our general ed classrooms. I still go in and see classrooms with children sitting reading only text at their instructional level because teachers are afraid. They're well-intentioned, but they're afraid that giving the kid a hard text is going to be too frustrating. We've got to change how we're teaching. We've got to change Tier 1 instruction. There is, okay, I see the next question. Ideally, how long should a child be in Tier 2? Well, Patricia, ideally, a poor child should never have to be in Tier 2, but that's not the reality of, you know, what's happening. And so some children, you know, how long a child is going to be in Tier 2 is dependent upon a couple things. Number one, it's dependent upon the child's individual needs. Number two, it's dependent on what type of intervention is the school providing. I'm going to tell you, if a child is in Salvatrice's class with 14 other kids, that kid could be in Tier 2. I can't guarantee that a child in that kind of setting is getting their needs met if there are 13 other kids in the class of a Tier 2 model, and they're only meeting twice a week. So that's very different than a Tier 2 that is something like a reading recovery type of model where it's very diagnostic or where it's based on a diagnostic model and you have four kids sitting in a Tier 2 setting with a crackerjack teacher who knows exactly what those needs are and is meeting those children's needs like hitting a bullseye on a target. That's very different than a situation than the situation like poor Salvatrice found herself in. So there is no one right answer for how long a child should be in Tier 2. It depends on what the Tier 2 looks like, and it depends on what the child's needs are. It depends on what the school's ecology is in terms of resources. So you've been seeing students in my group now since September at Tier 2. Well, it's only February. So, Patricia, I would question whether you did another. Are you doing your progress monitoring? That's the other thing. We want to do progress monitoring. I would have to ask you, what kind of progress monitoring are you doing on those children on a biweekly basis to monitor the kind of progress they're making and the two types of progress you want to look at? You want to look at achievement. Where are they now compared to the goal for children that are typically developing at that grade level? And the other thing is the rate of progress. What kind of rate of progress has the children in your tier two setting been making every 2 weeks when you progress monitor them? So that's one type of assessment that you want to use to gauge whether they should still be in Tier 2. And then how was their January screening? Did their January screening that you just completed, were they performing at proficient levels? So those are all questions that need to be asked. I see people who are doing screening are reporting, but remember, you do also want to be doing in your assessment audit, you want to be looking at what kind of progress monitoring are teachers using in Tier 2, Tier 3, and special education to ensure that what you're doing in the intervention setting is truly working with those children. think we want to use our data to make decisions. And this might, you know, if you have doubts about whether you're progress monitoring decisions, or whether you're doing your progress monitoring is informing you, you may want to go back to the webinar strand number 2. John Hintz's webinar strand that has already been posted on the RTI Technical Assistance Center has a wonderful way for you, has some wonderful information on helping you really refine your assessment system for identifying whether your children are, whether your assessment system is sensitive enough to identify where children need to be placed. I'm seeing some really great conversation. Thank you so much for this great conversation, and I look forward to all of you joining us in 2 weeks for the next webinar on complex text. And thank you all for attending, and thank you. Please be sure to fill out the evaluation that Molly has made available to you.
Okay, I'll post the link to the evaluation one more time. We do appreciate you completing that. Dr. Stahl, thank you so much for today. The recording of today's webinar as well as the PowerPoint slides will be on the New York State Technical Assistance Center webpage. I'll do it as soon as possible, at the latest the end of the day tomorrow, so you can watch for that. And everyone have a good night. Thank you all.
Thank you, everyone.